Welcome to Calming the Chaos podcast, where we help you find peace in a chaotic world. I'm Tracy Canella, licensed mental health counselor, certified eating disorder specialist, and advanced clinical hypnotherapist. Calming the Chaos podcast provides you with self-help resources for handling anxiety, stress, and overwhelm. It is not a substitute for counseling or psychotherapy. So if you like what you hear, please subscribe and share it with your friends. Thanks for tuning in. And now, let the chaos begin. I filmed this episode on March 27th, 2023, with Elizabeth Makatowicz. And Elizabeth has been through a lot of chaos. In fact, this episode is called A Radical Life of Chaos with Elizabeth Makatowicz. So she tells a lot of stories about her life that are very triggering. So I do want to put a trigger warning on here first and foremost for those of you who are sensitive to themes of domestic violence, drug abuse, drug addiction, drug dealing, women's shelters, and prison, because those are the themes that we'll be talking about with Elizabeth today as she shares her radical life of chaos. And most importantly, for those of you who don't want to get triggered and want to fast forward, I'll put a timestamp right here where you can fast forward and see all the wonderful things Elizabeth is doing with her life now that she's out of all of the chaos and she's gotten the help that she needs. She's doing some amazing things with her life. And if you just want to hear about the good stuff, then go ahead and fast forward to this timestamp. So now buckle up for those of you who want to continue watching as we talk to Elizabeth Makatowicz. I will be interjecting some of my thoughts and opinions inside of her stories that she tells during this podcast. Take care. Have a great summer. And again, thank you for listening to Calming the Chaos podcast.
5 years ago, I was painting murals as a federal inmate. I was locked up for a nonviolent drug charge that I got in as a result of a domestic violence relationship that I was trying to escape in my early 20s. I was assaulted, and you could see my skull when it happened. And they had to like sew the muscle back and then sew the skin back. And then I started getting seizures and I'd go deaf and blind for moments at a time. And my little girl was only 14 months old. So, you know, as a parent, you know, you're unconscious on the ground and you don't know how long you've been out for and you're the only one caring for her. So it was a really awful thing to face, like that I was no longer a safe caregiver for her. And it was of no fault of my own. But when you're going unconscious for however long, you know, no toddler is going to be safe. And when I went to the hospital, they pumped me full of opiates. And first I took them. But then when they put me in the pain clinic, I was like, I'm pregnant. I should not continuously be taking this stuff. Like, I don't want to get addicted. I don't want to get my baby addicted. And they told me I was on too small of a dose to get addicted and I shouldn't worry about it. But, you know, 15 years later, after the huge opioid epidemic that we've had, you know, that was just lies for Big Pharma's profit. And I was also told if I refused that it would result in a call to Child Protective Services where I was pregnant and my blood pressure kept skyrocketing from the amount of pain I was in, which is absolutely ridiculous because opioids make the pain receptors in your brain more sensitive. So you feel more pain once the drug wears off. And once you build a tolerance, it doesn't help you with pain at all. So, and they knew that. And so, you know, after I had my son, I had no reason to kind of put a lid on it and control myself. And I started taking more and, you know, doing more amounts and, you know, not really, it really helped with the trauma because it was numbing me.
Okay, so that was a lot. And now you see why I issued a trigger warning at the beginning of this podcast interview. So to break it all down, Elizabeth was a victim of domestic violence. She already had one child. She was pregnant with another child when she received a head injury from her current partner, where she had to be hospitalized. And while in the hospital, she also was given opiates. And when she was given opiates, they transferred her to a pain center that said that she had to be on even more opiates. Now, she didn't want to hurt her baby that was unborn, so she really didn't want to take the opiates. So what ended up happening was the pain clinic said, you'll be out of compliance if you don't take the opiates that we give to you. And if you are out of compliance, your blood pressure will go up so high that it'll be a danger to your unborn baby. And we will have to call CPS or Child Protective Services on you. To me, that is just a wild and crazy story about how things can happen in the hospitals and how well-meaning people can actually cause people more mental and emotional chaos. So before this next story, story number three, I have to issue another trigger warning because it's going to go into some details about domestic violence. And for those of you who are sensitive to themes of domestic violence, Elizabeth does go into some details about what happened. You know, they're pretty extreme. And so again, for those of you who are wanting to go to her next story, here's the timestamp for the next story. But story number three is actually centered on the details of domestic violence and the chaos that went on with Elizabeth.
This man was so sadistic. He would trap me in the bathroom and literally torture me for hours. I mean, it would start with me begging for my life and it would end with me begging him to kill me. I mean, he would like make me strip naked, get in the tub, and he'd be like, you're going to die there. And he'd, you know, come at me with knives, make me think I was going to get stabbed, you know, hold cigarettes right, you know, half an inch away from my eye, you know, just horrible, like psychological terrorizing. And he strangled me to the point my windpipe was damaged. And the doctors explained it to me, like, you know, when you have a plastic tube and it bends and, you know, even if you straighten it out, it still has that crease where it's, you know, weak. So my throat, my windpipe would, I'd be talking or, you know, whatever. Always when I got hiccups, it always happened to me when I got hiccups, my windpipe would just close in on itself and I wouldn't be able to breathe and I would have to chug water. And this would go on anywhere from like 10 minutes to 45 minutes of me just struggling to breathe. Like it wasn't like I my throat closed up or anything. It was like, it was just like stuck together and it was so scary and, you know, so traumatizing. And, you know, I eventually went to the battered women's shelter in Bangor called Spruce Run. And, first, they called me a liar because I wasn't crying. I was like completely in shell shock. I had no tears left. And they said most women come in there and they're crying or emotional. Because I didn't fit that description, they called me a liar. So I went and I got the cops that brought me to the emergency room and I brought them my medical records. Then they did a complete 180 and said, well, your injuries are so extensive. You know, we have two beds open, but your situation will put the other women in the shelter in danger. So we can't help you. And the girl that got the bed, the guy didn't even hit her. He just kicked her car. And, you know, here I was. You know, if I hadn't gone to the emergency room, I'd be dead. And they're turning me away.
Okay, wow. That was quite a story because Elizabeth was in desperate need of being in a battered women's shelter in story number four. And she was actually denied access to the shelter because her condition medically was so bad that they wanted not to trigger the other residents of the battered women's shelter. And so what Elizabeth had to do was seek services elsewhere, which was really nowhere. And so she had to resort to a different life and a different way of living, which you'll hear about in story number five.
So drug dealers protected me. They gave me places to hide. They gave me work, you know, drugs to sell as work. And I was tough enough and I was, you know, crazy enough from all the trauma. Like I wouldn't back down and I just would go ballistic if anybody tried, you know, messing with me because, you know, I was so traumatized and like I was quick to fight back. Like, you know, you get to that point where you just snap and you're not really in control of yourself. And, you know, honestly, it was empowering because, you know, selling drugs is a very misogynistic man's game. They expect women to be sex objects and, oh, here, you know, oh, you here, you can, I'll give you some drugs and you can, you know, blow me for it. That's pretty much the attitude towards women. And I did not, you know, I was tougher than most of the men at this point. And a lot of them found me intimidating. And so I kept going up this ladder that I didn't want to. You know, I was in college before. I had plans. And, you know, instead I was getting sucked into this life that I never wanted, you know, running with bikers, running with skinheads, running with, you know, all kinds of, you know, drug dealing thugs. And, you know, I eventually caught federal drug charges. And yeah, I went to federal prison and I got to see all of the chaos and cruelty and corruption within the prison system.
So story number five really paints an interesting picture about the desperate need of people to go to any extremes to take care of their homes and their families and to make livings. For Elizabeth, it resulted in drug dealing. And so she was drug dealing and working with some nefarious characters, and she did so to survive. And that's story number five.
I mean, I watched a woman go into labor, and the only reason they brought her to the hospital is because we threatened a riot. And when they told her, we're going to take you to the hospital, but if it's a false alarm, you're going to go into solitary. For wasting our time and money. Like, if you don't want to pay for a pregnant woman's medical care, then you need to let her out of jail. Wow. You know, this is like, for those of you who have had kids, you know, you have a false alarm in labor. You have Braxton Hicks, you know, things happen and you are going to punish a woman for thinking she was in labor and she wasn't. And, you know, I watched people die of very treatable medical issues. I mean, one girl broke her foot shoveling snow. That was her job. They make you work 40 hours a week for $5.25 a month. And she breaks her foot working. And by the time they took her to the hospital, they had to re-break her leg because the bone had fused back together. Like, that is completely unnecessary. It's torture. Like, that is like cruelty and torture, you know.
Wow.
just because you don't want to like properly get these people properly cared for.
Yeah.
And, I mean, my first week at Somerset County, I witnessed an entire pod of women get strip searched because they signed up for a razor and the male sergeant wanted a list of who shaved their vaginas and who didn't. Those that did were punished. Like, and this is just the PG stuff that goes on in there.
And, oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, America, we have the highest rate of incarceration, but it's more than that. We make up 20% of the global incarceration population. They're gaslighting us with land of the free, and we have more people in prison than entire continents. And we make up 5% of the world population. Like, this is all for profit. This is one big scheme for corporations to get money.
So here Elizabeth goes on a bit of a rant about cops and the systems that cops operate in. And I just want to let you know that that's not necessarily my opinion, but I do believe that corruption exists in all areas of work and life, and that sometimes it doesn't. And so we just need to keep our eyes out for signs of corruption in our personal lives and our systems. And that's the one piece of advice I'd probably suggest that you do, not just having a blind view of this is the way the system is, it's corrupt and everything is corrupt, because it's not necessarily so. There are some really good systems here in the United States and in other places. So just keep an open mind about that while being vigilant for signs of corruption.
I mean, a hospital saves $350,000 a year contracting their linen to be washed by inmates, so they don't have to pay regular Americans a minimum wage, not even a livable wage, a minimum wage. These corporations are so greedy, they don't even want to pay people a minimum wage. They would rather send, you know, the mundane, easy jobs to inmates and pay them nothing. So they're criminalizing all these people just to get a free workforce. And they're rebranding it as rehabilitation. There we go. There's the word I was looking for.
But here, you know, when you think about what you have been through, so you have really pretty much, so you had a little daughter, you were a victim of domestic violence, you got a really bad injury while you were pregnant, had to be hospitalized, and then there was a opioid thing to where they gave you opioids. They said that you weren't going to get addicted, but you did. And you had a seizure as a result of your head injury. And also this threat of having CPS take your kids away from you, being turned away at a DV shelter, the injury to your windpipe, and then the life of a drug, like, I guess still a victim of domestic violence. I assume you went back to him after all that happened?
He went to prison. And that's how, yeah, he got into a high-speed chase. He, after the last time he put me in the hospital, he came after me with a shotgun. He was sitting out on the fire escape of my friend's house. And they eventually got him. They sent a SWAT team after him and beat, like, they broke bones on him and they beat him right good. And he went away for like 3 years. And, you know, I was like trying to get my life back. But once I signed, I made a deal with my father when Spruce Run wouldn't help me. You know, he said, if he shows up with the cops, I'm going to have to hand your kids over. So you need to sign temporary guardianship. You can't care for them anyway, because your head injury. And in most days I couldn't, like, I was not, you know, a capable and safe caregiver for them because of this injury. And so I lost my health insurance after that. So not only could I not get, you know, myself properly medicated anymore, I couldn't go to therapy. I couldn't go to rehab. I couldn't do any of those things to fix myself. And, you know, in order to get any, you know, vouchers or funding to get a house for my kids, I have to have them in my custody, or you have to have, in order to get them in your custody, you have to have a big enough place for both of them and a safe place for both of them. It's like a catch 22,
right?
Like,
right.
It's this never ending, you know, revolving thing where, you know, you just can't succeed.
So story number 7 generally talks about how hard it is to adjust to life outside of prison after you've been in prison, and some of the adjustments you have to make to your life, and even trying to get mental health help, medication help, and care for your kids. And so I think the big takeaway from story number 7 is that we find a way to live inside prison systems and outside of prison systems. And sometimes we go back to the systems that we had previously gotten us into trouble. And sometimes we turn our lives around. And I think, you know, Elizabeth does a really good job of telling her own unique story about how she dealt with life after prison.
And, you know, when I got out of prison, I went to the pharmacy and the prison had me on $1,300 worth of psych meds and I had no way to pay for it. So I was like spacing these medications out and slowly spiraling and relapsing and, you know, just losing my mind, because mental health meds, when you just stop taking them, you go completely crazy. Like, and people don't understand how dangerous these medications are. They think, oh, I'm just going to take a pill and all my problems are going to go away. actually, if they get it wrong, or if you just stop taking it, it can have very, very dangerous, you know, effects on you. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up going back on probation, but I lucked out because when I got out, Janet Mills had taken over from Paula Page and she had expanded Medicare. So I was able to continue trauma counseling. I was able to get MAT treatment when I needed it. I was able to get, you know, properly medicated and get my issues, you know, fixed. And, you know, so I could maintain a healthy lifestyle and, you know, actually have resources to do so. And, you know, the amount of people that would be able to come up out of the gutter if they just had their basic needs met, and the amount of mental health issues that would just disappear if everyone had their basic needs met. I mean, it's just really kind of disgusting at this point.
Well, and you've been through the gamut, right? So after you were turned away from the domestic violence shelter, you pretty much went to a life of drugs and selling drugs.
Yeah. And, you know, your back's against the wall and that's what happens. People get desperate and they end up breaking the law when they never would have in the first place. Like I had no intentions on being a drug dealer or, you know, profiting off of other people's addictions, even though I was in my own addiction and I was sick at the time as well. Like, that's not something I'm proud of. Like, I'm not proud of the fact that I was selling a substance that was causing people to lose custody of their kids.
Right.
You know, so now I just talk about it and I try to educate people on, you know, what's really happening.
So story number 8 is kind of sad. Well, all of the stories are sad. Some of them make me angry and some of them make me really sad. But Elizabeth had to go back to prison for the same drug charge because there is no double jeopardy when you think about drug dealing, and it was a nonviolent drug crime. So she went to a state prison in Maine, and then they got her again and put her in federal prison when she, for the same charge. She also talks about being a privileged white woman and how she probably got less time because of it. And I really appreciate that she brought that part up because I think we need to know that privilege is extended to some people who are white and who are women that are not of color. And I really appreciate that she put that in there.
Well, my first charge was in the state, and then the feds picked it up 2 years later, and it was for the same drugs, the same substance. So, you know, there's no such thing as double jeopardy when it comes to drug dealers. The state can charge you for, you know, one particular bust, and then the feds can pick it up and charge you for that same bust. So, you know, yeah, I literally went to jail for the same drugs twice. It was the one and only time I ever got in trouble. But it was bad. And I was really lucky to walk out with only 3 years. You know, that prosecutor wanted a lot more out of me, but, you know, thank God I had the lawyer that I did. And, you know, I hate to say it, if I had been black or brown or anything other than a white woman, I would have gotten a lot more time. And that doesn't sit well with me, especially, you know, when this country is supposed to be about equality and be like a melting pot of all different cultures. It's not. It's not equal. It's not fair. It's none of that.
And awareness is really the key to change, right? So we're talking, you are aware of all these things that happen within the systems, all these different systems, and inside of the prison system as well. And you, I think you gave us a PG-13 version of prison life. And I know that if you're familiar with a creator, YouTube creator called Christina Randall, she's got a really popular YouTube true crime channel. And she talks about what it was like to be in prison. She did a whole extensive review of that for anybody who actually would like to know a little bit more about Christina Randall. I'll put the link below. And so anyway, so then when you got out the second time is when we finally got health insurance, counseling, medication, all the stuff that you needed to get supported.
Yeah, I was on probation when I got out from that 3 years, and I only lasted 6 months on probation. I literally had a panic attack every time I left my house, and I just kept smoking weed, kept relapsing, because like I felt like I was, you know, dangerous. Like if the, you know, the wrong man triggered me, I'd just go into attack mode and not, you know what I'm doing. So I was like terrified to leave my house. But the thing for me was marijuana would slow me down enough to where I would be able to process things and be like, okay, stop for a minute. And like, it would slow me down enough so I wouldn't just impulsively, you know, react. And it helped me sleep. It helped me eat. So, I mean, I'm all for medical marijuana. It's done wonders for me compared to, you know, well, I'm high functioning autistic. None of the medications work for me. And if I'm not telling people to, you know, get off their medications, I'm not pushing that. I'm saying for me personally, and you know, the way my body and my chemical makeup is set up, medications just don't work.
Wow. Yeah. And so you did get counseling as well as the medication, because those two typically work best in conjunction together.
Yeah, I did. And I tried all their medications. And what makes me the most angry, it's like, I told this one doctor, they put me on Seroquel in solitary and it put me into psychosis, and I ended up hurting myself to make the hallucination stop. And I wasn't trying to kill myself. I was just like trying to get it to stop. And she puts me on it again. And she's like, well, there's no paperwork saying that you actually took it. So it's like, oh, because I have a mental health diagnosis, my words don't matter. So I had to go on this medication again. And the same thing happened to me again. And it's just like, you know, when your mental health is weaponized against you by doctors and by therapists. And that's what makes me so angry. They have a PhD, so they think, oh, I clearly know everything. It's like, no, I'm living this. I'm telling you what doesn't work, and you're not listening to me because you have a PhD and I have a mental diagnosis.
Or an MD, yeah. If there's prescribing, they have usually an MD. Yeah, exactly. But okay, so, yeah, you know, we run into the same problem in the eating disorder field. When I hear clients, they go into, you know, residential treatment, they come in, they start to tell people, like, this medication's not working for me, and they're just not listened to. I think we could go a long way just to start to listen to and honor what we actually have to say about our own bodies what works well with our system and what doesn't. And Okay, so you talked about prison and about the, you know, PG-13 version of it, like I said, but there were some things that happened in prison that were not that bad, and in fact has shaped who you are today and has gotten really toward your rehabilitation as a person. How about describing some of the things that happened in prison that really were helpful for you?
You know, parents are very quick to give their children psych meds, and I wish they would wait till the kid's a little bit more like mature and grown, because the chemicals are still working themselves out. And if you know what happened to me, I don't want it to happen to other kids. Like, you give these kids the wrong medication, it can put them in psychosis. It can make them suicidal or homicidal when they never were before. And then, they have mental health issues. Well, they never had those kind of mental health issues before they were on this medication.
Well, okay. So you got involved in the drug world for survival, and then really you were actually working with, you said, a variety of pimps, dealers, thugs, nefarious characters, if you will, right? And so you actually got yourself into federal prison again for a second time. You want to tell us a little bit about that second time in federal prison?
So the women in there are just incredible. And I never found so much support from women. Like, I'm still friends with these women, and they're the first to share my brand or share my podcast when I go on them. There's so much legitimate support. None of that like shady hater energy, like secret, you know, women tearing each other down. Like, there's really none of that in there. It's literally, oh, you need something? Here you go. Let me help you. Like, there is a very much pass it on, you know, energy and, you know, culture in there. And it's just very different from, you know, on the outside, because, you know, we're all in there together. We've all been labeled trash by society. We've all been thrown away. And, you know, we're all kind of just supporting each other. Obviously, you got your bad apples, you know, it's prison. But, you know, I was so shocked about how supportive and, you know, amazing those women were. Like, I found family in there. And I also painted murals while I was in there. And I had a side hustle. I would paint cups and I would do personalized stuff for the other inmates. And, you know, it was kind of like giving them a piece of their identity back. You know, we're given a number, we're given the same clothes, you know, we're told, you know, you know, all of this, you know, oppressive stuff about ourselves. And, you know, you kind of just lose a sense of who you are because you're not really allowed to be authentic in there. So, I mean, even if it's just something as simple as a cup, something personalized that, you know, they wanted. And, you know, that was really cool. And I also took the Resolve program in the feds, which was really helpful. It introduced me to meditation and, you know, like affirmations and, you know, actually really like addressing my trauma and made me understand like what was actually happening to me and, you know, why I was reacting the way I was and, you know, why, you know, something 10 years ago felt like it happened 2 weeks ago. And, you know, once you start learning these things, you know, it's easier to navigate, you know, what you're dealing with. And it's not so overwhelming. And it doesn't just, you know, destroy your whole day like it did before. It's like, well, okay, I got triggered by this. And this is why. And, you know, that's the part of my brain that, you know, is doing this to me. And that makes it a lot easier to understand and deal with.
Well, I was going to ask you a question about the murals. Like, so is there just a blank wall someplace in the prison that they say, okay, you can go ahead and paint on this. And then I would think that you would run out of wall somewhere.
I got some pictures. There was a long, at Danbury, it has staggered floors. So, in between, like you can kind of see the glass down here. Like there's this white wall, like where the railings are. So they had me paint in all blue. This was my blue period. So, that was my Phoenix, starry sky. They let me do whatever I want, but I was only allowed to paint blue. Right. And then there were quotes. There were quotes like in between the murals. You did a silhouette.
Wow. And those are all on different walls?
Yeah. It's like you walk down a hallway and you get to walk by all these.
How cool.
All these paintings.
Yeah, somehow I envisioned that you would only have one wall and then you'd have to white over it and then do another mural after that. But they let you just sort of...
I literally went down the whole thing and, by the time I was done, I had like 20, 30 murals that I had done.
Wow. And, you know, I used to have a friend, she and I worked together in hypnotherapy, and she used to do these portraits of people's essence, like, let me paint your essence. And so I'm kind of imagining with the cups that you painted that you would maybe even ask them, what would you like me to paint on the cups? Or this is what reminds me of you, or this is your essence. And so it helps them to get their identity back when they're in prison.
Actually, I had this book. It was a tiny little like 500 page book of tattoo designs. So people would flip through that and pick out, you know, what they wanted.
Oh, neat. That is so cool. So you were painting, you took a class, the class that actually was helping you to learn yoga and skills and some other sorts of things to be able to calm your chaos, I guess. It was called the Resolve Program. Is that what you said?
Okay. It's a 5-step program. It takes like 18 months to do the whole thing. I wasn't there long enough to even get through half of it. But the part that I did do was really helpful and really impactful. They have something called the RDAP program too, which is for drugs, and it's very in-depth, like rehabilitation. And yeah, that program helps a lot of people too. I didn't get to do it. I didn't have enough time, and I wouldn't have gotten the year off. So I was like, yeah, I'm not going through all that just to, if I'm not going to get anything out of it.
Yeah, they always say that it's hard or difficult when you get out of prison to integrate back into life again and to figure out how to do life, what to do. What was that like for you when you got out the second time and had to just sort of figure out your life?
You know, everything moves so fast when you get out of prison. And, you know, they did a study on the brain in solitary, and your brain literally slows down from the lack of stimulation. So when you have a situation that's like normal stimulation level, it feels like absolute chaos, you know, and you have to, like, your brain's literally been rewired. So, I mean, any, like, going to the store to pick out toothpaste was so overwhelming. Like, I mean, you go to commissary, you have like one or two things to pick from, if that. And, you know, now all of a sudden you have this like wall of options, and it's like little things like that become so overwhelming. And, you know, I used to do dumb stuff like leave the water on. I used to drive my mother nuts too, because you in prison, you have these buttons, you push the button and the water's on for a second and then it goes off. So you get used to doing that. And it's like little things like that. And it really throws you off. And like, I still panic every time I order food. It's like, oh my God, what do I do? Like, it's just like very overwhelming, like having your own choice.
Yeah. You never had that choice in prison, right?
Yeah. And it's like, you feel like you're on the spot and you don't know what to do. And it's like, you can't, like, I have such a hard time deciding like little things, like what I want to order for food, or, you know. And when I got in the car for the first time, it felt like we were going like 100 miles an hour. And, you know, I look over and we're going like 45. Mm-hmm. So, you know, everything feels chaotic when you get out of prison.
And so it moved faster. It's too much, too fast, right?
Yes. And like, when I got out of solitary, people talking over each other would overwhelm me. And I would just like go right back to my cell at lockdown, because it just, like, my heart would race. And like, the first thing that goes to your head is like, who do I got to fight to get out of here? And I don't understand why, like, your first, you know, thought is violence, probably because they've used violence on you in solitary, and that literally becomes the conditioning. But your first thoughts are literally like, I got to get out of here. Like, who do I got to go through to get out of here? And, you know, that's what solitary does. It like shuts your empathy off, and it shuts your like human connection off.
Are you talking about going into solitary, like in the hole sort of thing? You were okay.
Yeah.
So as a disciplinary action, you'd be in the hole. And then when you come out, you'd be overwhelmed by just regular goings on in the prison.
Oh yeah.
And then when you were in the hole, you were trying to figure out how to fight your way out.
Well, you can't fight your way out. You're locked in, but, if they feel bored or they want to mess with you, they come in, toss your cell, push you up against the wall, say you reacted just so they can spray you. I mean, it's really quite cruel what they do.
Wow.
I mean, well, I had a sergeant telling me to kill myself in solitary while I was on the wrong medication in psychosis. And then it was in the paper that she told another inmate to kill themselves, and they had to cut that inmate down from a suicide attempt. He tried to hang himself. And she's still working there. She's still getting her pension.
Yeah, you know, they say that about, Jeffrey Epstein, right? Like, did he actually commit suicide, or was he coerced or whatever in prison? And the kids now, it's a very popular thing for kids to tell other kids in school to kill themselves. It's just kind of popular to do that now. And I think it's just awful. And so it's going on in the prison systems, is going on out here as well, for sure.
Right.
Well, so then how did you kind of find your way in this world? I guess, what are you doing now? And how did you find your way from getting out of prison and getting through all the stimuli to what you're doing right now?
You know, I stayed away from my old friends. And, you know, you can't get better in the environment that made you sick. And I started working at hotels and doing cleaning jobs, you know, jobs I didn't have to deal with, like, public, you know, randomly, and, you know, customer service, like, you know, jobs where I was in control of, like, who I went around. And because people were very triggering to me, and they all made me nervous. Like, I mean, I'd flip a coin in my head if a man was a predator or not. And it's just, it's very hard and it's very strange. But, you know, we're not around men that don't have some sort of authority and power over us, unless if it's like our lawyer or our family coming to visit us. So we're not around men unless if they're in like a position of authority over us. And it's just very bizarre. And I worked, I started contracting my own cleaning jobs. I started having my own art shows over the pandemic. One was during Addiction Awareness Month, and I entered some writing contests and I won and got published 2 years in a row. Nice. And then I found Le Galeriste. They're a Canadian company and they transform your art into this beautiful feminine, you know, clothing line. It's environmentally friendly. It comes in plus sizes. And, you know, the thing I was so happy about, you know, you work with, you know, people that have eating disorders. Well, I remember, like, as, you know, 12, 13, when I was a little bit chunkier, you know, putting on, you know, a pant size and not having gained any weight, you know, the size was just way too small. And it's like society shoves skinny down women's throats and, you know, bases our worth on how skinny and how beautiful we are. And it's just absolutely dehumanizing and ridiculous. And this brand, when I ordered it, like, I'm very skinny now. But I ordered a small and it was too big for me. And I'm like, this sizing is great. It's not going to make anyone feel bad about themselves. It's not going to contribute to this, you must be skinny, and if you're not, you can't wear this brand. Like, no, like, I want everybody to be included in this brand, and I want everybody to feel empowered by these clothes. And, you know, I painted these designs on my own healing journey. And, you know, I'm not excluding anybody. Like, I want everybody to, you know, feel empowered and beautiful wearing this stuff. And, you know, I was just, everything fits so well. Like, it doesn't matter what type of body you have and what shape you are. Like, these clothes are very flattering to everybody's figure. Mm-hmm. And I was just so impressed that, you know, they have things sized properly so that it's not going to affect people's mental health.
And they just put your artwork on clothes or make patterns out of it? Or do you have some creative input besides the designing of the artwork? Do you have some creative input?
Well, I can pay money to have them, like, checkered or repeat designs. I usually just go with the whole painting, though, because I like showing off the whole painting. But yeah, there's all kinds of different things you can do.
Wow. So your own clothing designs and your artwork on them. And then you said you started to sell your artwork as well, right?
Yep. Well, I do a lot of portraits for people and I do a lot of charity events and I donate a lot of stuff. And usually people will commission me. I do brand logos and stuff like that. I've done a couple brand logos and stuff for businesses. Those are always fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, so is your clothing on your website? Is that where it's at? Is are there examples of the, and your website being the Lioriste? Is that right? Is that's the one it is?
Yep.
Yeah, let's take a trip over there and see if we can look at some of Elizabeth's artwork and artwork and clothing here.
Le Galeriste.
Le Galeriste, okay. Yeah. EPM clothing. And so here are some examples of some clothes that are made up from Elizabeth's artwork. You can see a, looks like a, it says fish sweater knit. I guess this
is I actually have that right here. Yeah, it's a shawl. And everything is so well made. Like, I just, the quality is just to die for. And, you know, the colors are so bright and vibrant. Yeah, this is like very large. And, you know, you can put it like,
you can wear it.
Yeah, you can wear it like this, or you can wear it like a scarf. You know, it's, there's a couple things you can do with it. And I'm really impressed.
And you said that the clothing, the actual fabric, there's something special about the actual fabric of these clothes as well?
Yes, it's all like synthetic, oh my God, I'm drawing a blank now. that head injury kicking in. It's a synthetic,
I'm trying to see if it says it on it says a lot about the artwork, but I remember you saying that there was just, it was pretty all natural materials, not non-synthetic and sort of materials.
Green, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it seems green. Like you've got your fish design, Lucky Koi fish design in a couple of different sorts of pieces. And then this is your moon on the water.
Yeah, this is the placemat that you see right in the top.
Oh, yeah, it looks just like the scarf, only it's a placemat.
Yeah.
So if you like the design, there's other things that you can order.
Yeah, you can literally match whole outfits. I mean, you can get headbands, you can get shirts, you can get pants, there's dresses. I mean, there's bags.
And I see these dresses, the same design, but in different styles and in shirts. And these are really neat. Oh my gosh, the one with the, what is the story behind the woman in the picture that we're looking at here?
So you can actually look, you can see the original paintings. If you go up at the top somewhere, I was painting that in the halfway house. And I call it Before She Falls. She's an angel kind of sitting there with a tear rolling down her cheek. And there's just this demon behind her.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Okay. So here are some of the art designs. There she is before she falls. Yep. So what you do is you go to the, click on the art tab here of that website, and then you hover your cursor over it and it top. Okay. So here's the Von Trapp family crest here. Okay. And there's the Ohm. You have so many designs and you've made clothing items out of every one of these designs.
Yep.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Let's go back home here. I just want to see some of these styles here because I do see this interesting. Are you the one that designs the shape of the dresses as well?
Well, they have, I pick out which dress they have. They have like a library of things you can pick from.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll just click like 10 things that I wanted on. And yeah, then a couple days later, they send me this. And the ones that I like, I keep. And the ones that I don't. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Wow. And I see that most of the colors of the chakra are represented here. Isn't that cool?
Yeah. Very spiritual.
Yeah. And then, so here's all, I guess you can have all the products, though I think we just went through all of them.
No, there's a lot more than that. It's just, it doesn't show on the original page.
Okay, yeah. Like you have to go over to the left. And so here's some of the pants and stuff.
Yep.
Home accessories, men's. Let's look at the men's t-shirts here. Okay, right on.
It's mostly feminine, but yeah.
There's some masculine in there, right? I guess if we want to think of it that way.
There's a couple masculine things in there.
I could probably just get lost in this website for sure. So, but all the artwork is here, And then I don't know if we go into collections. This is probably just being built right now, and there's some more products. So really just a lot to choose from. I'd really encourage everybody to go to Elizabeth's website and just kind of mess around and look around and see what you can see. It's really super cool. You can see that, and I'll also have it in the notes for the description of this video, how you can click on it. And for sure. So what else you got going on? As if that wasn't enough, I think you've got other things that you've done. Especially, you know, so all this stuff came from prison and being inspired. But I mean, were you able to come up with this idea of creating clothing on your own, or did somebody help you? Did you work with somebody?
Actually, it just kind of popped up on my Facebook one day, and I was like, oh, that's really cool. And then I started going to vocational rehab. If you have like a diagnosis or, you know, prison background, addiction, anything, I recommend signing up for vocational rehab. They got me a business advisor. They helped me make a business plan. I got a $10,000 business grant. I'm sitting there like, oh my God, I've never gotten that much money legally before. Like, this is amazing. And
I like the way you added legally in there, right? Yeah, DVR is so wonderful. They're a great organization. And if you qualify, you can get through all the red tape that it takes to get in there. They can offer some really, really good service for physical disabilities and for mental health, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very tedious, like 2.5 hour questionnaire thing I had to go through, but it was so worth it. And, you know, they're always helping me. Like, I always go to them first because, like, I don't really know anything about business. I didn't go to college for it. You know, I know how to market and, you know, hustle, but when it comes to actually running a real business, like, I've never done that before. You know,
they help you do it at DVR. Yeah. They do. I'll see if I can do a national link for Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. But you have, everybody has one in their own state too. And then typically, since it's a state agency, it's going to be near a city near you. So anybody could access it. But yeah, it's Division of Vocational Rehabilitation or DVR. Well, one of the things, Elizabeth, that you have told me that you've done that's very important, that's also been a process of your healing, was working in the system, not in the prison system, but within our legal system. Can you tell us a little bit about how you have helped form some legislation for more vulnerable populations who struggle with issues like domestic violence, addiction, and mental illness?
Well, this actually started because a cop in Calais, Maine got drug charges for giving a high school student drugs to give to her mother, who was giving him sexual favors for the drugs. So they only charged him with the drugs. And I called the DA up right pissed off because I'm like, why wouldn't you charge him with a sex crime? He extorted her addiction. He's a 30-year-old cop. Or he's been on the force for 30 years. He is well-versed in addiction. You know, if a cop came up to me as a woman who'd been to prison, you know, the only thing I'm thinking is, what is he going to put me in jail for when I say no? And that's the reality of it. You know, cops, there should be no such thing as consent with cops. They hold power over us. You know, we don't have the right to say no, especially if we already have felonies or we're on probation. And, you know, he just used her addiction against her. And so the DA was like, I understand what you're saying. And honestly, if I could charge him, I would. But the way the law is written, it was technically consent. But if you want to change that law, you should write to the state representatives. And so that's what I started doing. I started writing to them, and they actually listened to me, and they put my proposal regarding that into a bill. That one hasn't passed yet, but we did just get passed that all jails in the state of Maine provide tampons and pads free of charge for women. And, you know, before they, some places would have tampons, but it was rare, and you could buy them on the commissary if you had money, but they triple charge. And like I said, they pay you pennies a day. Like a package of ramen noodles cost 20 cents out here. It costs $1.50 in there.
I mean, and you may have had some people contribute to your commissary, but typically that's not the case with most people in prison.
Right. And if they're not, they'll take your money from you if you owe fines or child support or anything like that. So,
yeah.
And the other one that just got passed was the Tenants Bill of Rights. We had landlords. We went from one homeless encampment to like 10 in a matter of a couple years. And keep in mind, America has 29 empty properties for every homeless man, woman, and child. So these landlords are creating this issue, and they're doing it by charging application fees, and they'll get 10 application fees in a week. So in a month, they'll get three times the rent. You know, they're charging anywhere from $50 to $200 per person sometimes applying. And it's just free money to them. They are literally getting application fees just to tell people no.
Wow.
And they're not even looking at the applications. So this is a scam. And I went to the state representatives about it. I went to city council about it because, you know, the homeless population was just exploding. And, you know, the city hall was overwhelmed. Everybody was overwhelmed. And you have these landlords laughing all the way to the bank. And so they wrote legislation that said you cannot charge an application fee unless if a lease is signed. So, you know, the state of Maine done away with that. But the rest of the country needs to catch up because this is causing a very bad homeless crisis. And now in other states, they're doing processing fees. Like processing fee on top of the application fee. Like you people are crazy. Like it's like the banks and their overdraft fees. It's just free money to them.
Yeah, they used to call that like nickel and diming people. I don't know if they still call it that now, but gosh, yeah. I didn't know anything about that going on. If we wanted to research that and, you know, any kind of articles, where would you, is there a certain publication that you would lead us to? Or if you can,
the Bangor Daily News. And the, yeah, it's called like the Tenant Bill of Rights in Maine. Literally just passed like the last, but the one I'm, the law and the bill I have really been fighting for, regards, holding jail facilities financially accountable for every day they stonewall an inmate on their paperwork. So I filed a PREA complaint against Somerset County when they forced me to strip in front of cameras under duress of being extracted, maced. That's when they show up 12 deep, all in SWAT gear and have, you know, batons, electric shock shields. This is what they use on women, unarmed women by themselves, you know, 12 against one with rubber bullets and, you know, mace or canisters that are chemically designed to take the oxygen out of your lungs. And so I was forced to strip in front of these cameras. The cameras were illegal to have in those cells to begin with. You're not in the state of Maine. You cannot have a camera inside of a cell where an inmate goes to the bathroom and where they live. They do. And they love watching women get stripped out in front of those cameras, especially some of the male officers at Somerset County. Like they, it's known. They just love doing it. It's the power. And, you know, when
what do you want to get reversed and what do you want to see happen in regards to this issue?
So when I went to Alderson, I filed the PREA against them. When they got the response back from, Somerset had admitted to everything I was complaining about, but they deemed it unfounded. Alderson wouldn't even let me hold it to read it myself. They read it to me and then told me I couldn't have a copy of it. This is how they're burying the abuse. They are just not giving inmates the paperwork. They wouldn't let me send it home. And you only have 100 days to file an actual complaint when you get out. So if you don't have the paperwork, they won't do anything because they want to go, oh, well, where's the paper trail? Where's the proper chain of command? Well, I did it. They just won't give it to me. And then when I got out, the captain and four of his subordinates at Alderson all got convicted of raping and stalking inmates and tampering with PREA evidence. So I was not the only one they did it to. And a lot of inmates got it a lot worse than I did. And when I requested the paperwork from Somerset County when I got out, they told me I had to get a lawyer to subpoena it. And by law, they're supposed to give it to me, but there's no consequence for them if they don't.
If they don't.
So, yeah. And so you can't subpoena anything if you don't have an open case, and you can't have an open case without the paperwork. So it's this catch-22 again and this loophole, and they know it. So I'm pushing for legislation that says for every day they stonewall an inmate or refuse to give the paperwork, it's $500.
Whoa.
You know,
that ought to get them on their toes if that goes through.
Yeah. Well, I'm working towards it, and I've got people on board, but they're trying to figure out, you know, the messiness of it. It's a whole, you know, cause we're going to have cop unions and everything else showing up protesting this, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, what's the problem? Why can't you have the paperwork?
Exactly.
If you're so innocent, you know, they love enforcing the law, but they don't like to abide by it.
Mm. Well, it's a very eye-opening what you are saying, and it's really encouraged me to do some more research on what's going on in my own state. I think that's probably where we should all start, because if we were going to try and do all 50 states, that would be... Elizabeth, you have so much energy, and you were in the state of Maine when all of this happened. I don't know that you're living there now, but it's so nice that you're able to focus on that state and the legislation in that state, for sure. So
yeah, I'm actually down south in... a more of a red area, and they have a term for it, for when, you know, more liberals come to these red states. They call it red trauma. Like, there's an actual like term for it.
Are you red trauma? Is that what you're saying?
It's very shocking. I mean, I literally had conservative women tell me when I got out of prison, if you don't want to get raped by cops, then you shouldn't break the law and go to jail. Like, just say you're okay with cops being predators, because that's what you mean.
Oh, so they just, they try to discourage you from doing the work that you're doing?
Oh yeah. They tell me I need to go on meds. They tell me I'm crazy. I'm like, you know what? I am kind of crazy after all this. I'm not
passionate
to be anything but what I'm saying to you is facts, and it's not right what's happening. And you to justify raping a woman because she's in prison is disgusting. You know, there was a great quote, a nation cannot be judged by how it treats its highest members of society, but only how it treats its lowest.
I've heard that.
America is falling, you know, incredibly short. Mm.
Well, you seem to have a lot of energy and passion for this. And I think that if you're going to go forth and try and do good in this world, there's all different ways to do it. And I'm just so glad that we have you to fight for some proper legislation to represent some more vulnerable population, for sure. And so I remember when we were talking, I said, oh, so when is your book coming out? And you said that you had written a book, but you were in the editing process. You want to tell us a little bit about the book? I can't promote it here because it doesn't have a website or anything, but we can at least enjoy the title and keep Elizabeth in mind and see if you can, I don't know how, well, I guess we're going to introduce your social media. You'll probably, when the book comes out, you'll probably advertise it on your social media. So we'll give the social media in just a second, but tell us about your book.
So I started writing a memoir when I was in prison and just kind of like documenting what happened to me and what I saw. And, you know, I didn't write about my crime because you're not allowed to do that and profit off of it. But I wrote about my punishment and about my recovery. And, you know, one of the first cells I was ever in, it's someone wrote on the wall, there's no justice in the system. It's just us in the system. So I'm calling my book No Justice, Just Us. And yes, it's a massive trigger warning to be, it gets into some really awful, horrible things. I mean, I've met veteran women in prison who were thrown away by the military because they stood up to their rapist, and the military doesn't like it when you do that. They'd rather protect the predator. And, you know, I met tons of women who just, they, you know, their lives fell apart afterwards. And, you know, I met women that were, sterilized against their will in prison, and not a single one of them were white. This was all women of color. And this happened before Trump filled up the ICE camps with refugee mm-hmm. women, and they were doing it to them. They were doing this to American women, you know, for decades before. And it's just, I mean, the systemic oppression and cruelty that is still going on in America is just, I mean, you wouldn't even believe it. I didn't believe it until I had it up in my face. You know,
yes, you are the most radical guest I've ever had on my podcast. And that's why I'm saving you to the very end. I may have a season five, yes. I may not. So you may actually be my very, very last guest on the Calming the Chaos podcast. Oh, so we'll see. We'll see. But thank you again. And you take good care.
You too.
Thanks.